Live and local, this is a Juno Afternoon. It's Wednesday, June 28th, 2017, and I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. On today's show, we'll hear from Kate Burkhart from the Office of the Ombudsman. Mike Blackwell from the City Museum will be here to tell us about the Downtown Geology Walking Tour. We'll get an inside look at Perseverance Theater's Treadwell Gold from the actors who are performing in the play, Boston Christopher and Frank Tass. And those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Burn Note, and more are coming up right here on a Juno afternoon. Weather for today, scattered rain showers, highs around 60, and tonight, cloudy with lows around 50.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Citizens of the Blackfeet Nation in northern Montana rejected a measure Tuesday to reform their tribal constitution. Slightly less than 3,000 of the more than 13,000 eligible voted in the election, with more than 1,600 voting in opposition. The vote comes a year after the Tribal Business Council approved the proposal, which would have revamped the structure of the tribe's government by establishing a three-branch system. The tribe will retain its current 9-member single-branch governing body. Supporters say the new structure would have addressed failures in the current system and protect tribal members from government corruption. Opponents say the measure would have concentrated too much power in the president's office and feared the proposed language could have opened up enrollment. A local archaeologist believes the remains of a historic Aleutic fish trap is on the north end of Kodiak Island in southwest Alaska. He says those types of discoveries are rare in the region. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
The Aleutic Museum and Archaeological Repository is in its second year of documenting ancestral sites on Afognak Native Corporation lands. While surveying one area, Museum Curator of Archaeology Patrick Saltonstall says he noticed something on the shoreline at low tide. He says he identified it as a fish trap.
They're like stone walls in the intertidal zone. So when the tide came in, you know, all the fish waiting to go upstream would float in over the corrals or the trap, and then when the tide went out, they'd be stranded in the pens, and so then you could catch a whole lot of fish.
He says he saw evidence of the corral being a man-made rather than natural formation.
I could tell that there were some boulders that they used that were there already, but almost all of it was bringing boulders in. It's like a wall, like 5 feet across and maybe 2 feet high now, but probably much higher in the day.
He says they found what looks like petroglyphs nearby, speckled dots and incised lines carved into slate. And he says they found similar markings near other fishing sites. He says it's challenging to determine the age of either the corral or the petroglyphs, but based on nearby archaeological sites, the carvings could be dated back to about 500 years ago. For National Native News, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
The owners of a coal-fired power plant on the Navajo Nation are expected to sign a lease agreement this week with the tribe, which would keep it open through 2019. During a special session and hours of discussion Monday, the Navajo Nation Council approved the lease for the Navajo Generating Station. Located in Arizona, it provides electricity to customers in Arizona and Nevada. Supporters say the plant provides hundreds of jobs for Navajo people and revenue to the tribe. Council members who voted in favor say it also provides time for the tribe to explore other energy sources, including renewable energy and other economic opportunities. Those in opposition were concerned the legislation included a threat to tribal sovereignty, the request for the tribe to waive Navajo law in any potential litigation. The agreement still needs the signature of the Navajo Nation president. The family of two Navajo sisters who were found dead earlier this year with their children in a remote area in New Mexico announced this week they're launching a private investigation. Vanessa and Letitia George and their three children were found on tribal land near Albuquerque in January after being reported missing. Law enforcement say they found no foul play in the deaths. The medical investigator determined the deaths were due to exposure. The George family wants a new investigation and has hired an attorney and a private investigations firm. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at RamonaFarms.com. Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're tuned into a Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and here with me is my first guest, Kate Burkhart from the Office of the Ombudsman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, Kate, before we get into why you're here and what you do, tell us a little bit about yourself. I know you have a little bit of history of a connection with KTOO.
Sure. So I started hosting radio shows on KRNN 10 years ago when we had the opportunity to expand from one radio station to three in Juneau. And so I've been a volunteer DJ on KRNN since 2007, sometime in the winter of 6 and 7. And have hosted a whole variety of shows over the years. And currently, I get to host the Tuesday edition of Tideline from 5 to 7.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's always so nice to see you around. And it's great to have you as a guest on a Juneau Afternoon as well.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay, so tell us, for those who don't know, what does an ombudsman do?
The Alaska State Ombudsman is part of the legislative branch. A governmental ombudsman is part of the checks and balances around government. They tend to have jurisdiction over executive branch agencies, and they are an advocate for fair government. So the role of the ombudsman is to investigate complaints about how state government is serving its citizens. So it's a little different from a consumer protection office or a public advocate in that the ombudsman has to be objective. So they are not an advocate for the complainant, and they're not an advocate for the executive branch. They're completely impartial, and their job is to ensure that state government is serving its citizenry as well as possible. And our statutes provide standards and all of that to help us do our job.
I see you brought a giant thick book of statutes. I wish I could take a picture of it.
Well, it is my third official day, so I brought backup material to make sure
that's the biggest cheat sheet I've ever seen.
To make sure that I got the information right.
Well, thank you for being prepared. And even though you're fairly new to the office, you sound like you know what you're talking about.
Well, I had the opportunity to serve under the previous state ombudsman, Linda Lord Jenkins, who just retired, many years ago. So for about a year, I got to be an assistant ombudsman here in the Juneau office. And now I've come back, and I'm very privileged and honored and a little humbled and a little scared to be the state ombudsman now. But I've inherited a great team of people, and it's really great work. And so very exciting.
Oh, I'm certain you can handle it and that the affairs are in good hands with you.
Well, I appreciate that.
And you're here on the show today not really to promote anything specific, but just to talk a little bit more. Well, we already gave a little bit of an overview, but to talk about what kinds of things this office does. So maybe you can give us a couple of examples.
Sure. So that's the immediate question I always get is, what is an ombudsman and what do you do? And so the state ombudsman has been in the news recently. The office published two reports last week related to the Office of Children's Services. So that would be an example. So a large proportion of the complaints that the office receives are from individuals and families that are engaged with the Office of Children's Services, which not unexpectedly is a complicated and often emotionally charged system trying to protect Alaska's children. So we spend a lot of time on those complaints. So a citizen comes with a complaint, and our office looks to see if the complaint is jurisdictional. And because the Office of Children's Services is a state executive agency, we have jurisdiction. And then we have state standards about what we can investigate. And so we look at whether the state actions were unlawful, so not in accordance with state or federal law, unfair or unreasonable, arbitrary or capricious, which just means no one can tell why the decision was made, based on a mistake of fact or on irrelevant or improper grounds, whether the state's actions were inefficient or discourteous or otherwise an error. So those are spelled out in our statute. So we use those to help us figure out whether it's a complaint we need to look at. If we decide that we're going to investigate a complaint, we have professional standards that focus on our independence, and I talked about that a little bit before, that being part of the checks and balances, we are objective and independent. Impartiality or objectiveness is a big objectivity, is another of our professional standards. Confidentiality, we have really strict confidentiality standards in our statutes, and we protect the identities of our complainants and the information in our complaints to make sure that we can investigate fairly and a credible review process. And so often we can determine whether a state action meets those problems that our statute points out, and we can encourage the state agency to solve that problem informally. And that's a big chunk of the work we do. But sometimes that's not how it works out. And so there's a much more in-depth investigation and much more formal recommendations. And that's those reports you saw last week are the result of that. So it's a mix of investigations that result in a informal and quicker solution or a more complex investigation and a more formal recommendation. The ombudsman does not actually have the authority to make anyone do anything, so we try to work really hard to ensure that our recommendations are based in the best information and best practices as possible, so that they add value to the work of the state. Because again, we're our purpose is to advocate for fair and equitable government, and that government runs as well as possible. So our recommendations are meant to add value.
How has the proceedings of this legislative session affected the office?
The ombudsman is specifically a nonpartisan, nonpolitical office. And so unless there's a piece of legislation that's meant to address a problem the ombudsman has been involved with or about the ombudsman themselves, the office doesn't tend to get too embroiled in the political process. This year's a little different because they decided that they needed to appoint a new ombudsman. So that was part of the deliberations during the session this year.
Very interesting. Okay, let's try something. Maybe you can finish this sentence for me.
Okay.
I should contact the ombudsman if...
If you feel like a state agency has made a mistake or treated you unfairly or has not followed its policies or procedures or laws. So a random example would be that you, you, Shelley, went to get a fishing license, and they said no fishing license for you and didn't explain why. And so that would be an example. You would say to the ombudsman, I don't know why, but I didn't get a fishing license. I'm sure, first of all, you buy your fishing license at the grocery store. So it's just a random example. And I'm sure that no one would deny you a fishing license.
No one has yet.
But things like the Division of Motor Vehicles, if you encounter a problem there or in getting any kind of professional license, child support, issues relating to insurance and the Division of Insurance. The ombudsman has jurisdiction over all state agencies, so all the places where Alaskans interact with state government. The ombudsman does not have jurisdiction over court proceedings and cannot review or make recommendations related to judicial decisions. So if your court case goes awry, the ombudsman cannot probably help you.
And that's good to clarify that.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say I go to get my fishing license and I don't get it and I want to contact the Office of the Ombudsman. What do I do?
So you can call the Juneau office at Well, you'll call our intake specialists at 465-4970. You can also file a complaint online. Just Google Alaska Ombudsman, and you can use our website. You can also see synopses of our work on our website to get a better sense of what we do. But I encourage folks to, if you have a question or concern, to just go ahead and call. A lot of the work that our intake staff does is actually helping direct people to the right resources. And so it may not be that the ombudsman can help you, but typically we can refer you to someone who can, especially since the ombudsman does not have jurisdiction over city governments. And a lot of times people are calling because they have a problem with something happening in their city. And so we tend to try to find the right resource in their community to refer them to.
That's very helpful. Fantastic. Well, thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to add as part of this interview?
Well, I think most Alaskans either don't know about the ombudsman or don't really understand how the ombudsman can help. And so I would just encourage people, when in doubt, call. The worst thing that could happen is we say, we don't have jurisdiction, but we can refer you to someone who can help you, rather than just going without any assistance, because government is sometimes hard to navigate.
Sometimes. So that's wonderful advice, Kate. Thank you. I think you're a fantastic spokesperson. You're going to make a terrific ombudsman.
Well, thank you. I'm going to do my best.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for being here. And again, if you have questions or would like to contact the Office of the Ombudsman, you can call 465-4970 and ask for Kate.
Well, you want to talk to the intake specialist right now. I'm only on day 3.
All right, thanks. And listen to Tidelines, Tuesdays 5 to 7.
Absolutely.
All right, thanks. Here's Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 28th of June, 2017. It's the birthday of the man who wrote Man is Born Free, and Everywhere He Is in Chains, who believed that modern progress had corrupted rather than improved mankind. In his book on the origin of inequality, he wrote that civilization had led to most of what was wrong with people, that living in a society led to envy, that owning property led to social inequality, possessions led to poverty, and so forth. And who believe that government is unfairly weighted in favor of the rich. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, born in Geneva in 1712, his most famous book was The Social Contract, which had a big effect on the French Revolution. They adopted the slogan from Rousseau, liberty, equality, and fraternity. It was in the early hours of this day in 1969, the Stonewall riots broke out in New York City, in Greenwich Village. The Stonewall Inn was a popular hangout for gays, lesbians, transvestites in the late 60s. And early in the morning on this day, 1969, police raided the bar on the premise that it was selling alcohol without a liquor license. It was the third raid on a gay bar in Greenwich Village in a very short period of time. And this time, when the cops arrived, the patrons did not disperse. They fought back. The police barricaded themselves inside the bar. And in retrospect, it was considered the beginning of the gay rights movement. The first gay pride parades were held on this date in Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and elsewhere. A witness at the time said, "We weren't going to be walking meekly in the night and letting them shove us around. The bottom line was, we weren't going to go away, and we didn't." And it's the birthday of Gilda Radner, Detroit, 1946, moved to Toronto, joined an improv comedy troupe there, Second City, where she met John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, and the three of them became part of the original cast of Saturday Night Live in 1975. Here's a poem for today by Marge Piercy, June 15th, 8 p.m. The evening comes slowly over us, over the cardinal and the wren still feeding, over the swallows suddenly swooping to snatch up mosquitoes, over the marsh where the green sedge lately has a tawny tinge, over two yearlings bending long necks to nibble hillock bushes finely separate from their doe mother. A late hawk is circling against the sky, streaked lavender. The breeze has quieted, vanished into leaves that still stir a bit like a cat turning round before sleep. Distantly, a car passes and is gone. Night gradually unrolls from the east, where the ocean slides up and down the sand, leaving seaweed tassels, a perfect world for moments. A poem by March Piercy, June 15th, 8 p.m., from her collection Made in Detroit, published by Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Magoosh, online test prep for the ACT, SAT, GMAT, GRE, LSAT, and MCAT. Prep smart, go far, enjoy the ride at magoosh.com. And by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It is 22 minutes after the hour. You're tuned into a Juno afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and with me are my next guests, both very Juno-famous actors / playwrights / super talents, Boston Christopher and Frank Koshkatas.
Well, thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Someone once said that when you act at Perseverance, you become Fred Meyer famous.
Everyone recognizes you as Fred Meyer.
Oh, my gosh. I'm stealing that. Yeah. Fred Meyer famous is better.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you guys are both in the new play, Treadwell Gold, at Perseverance Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had the author of the book here on the show, Sheila Kelly. We've had the playwright on the show, Rachel Adkins. But you're here to talk about your experience being in the play and maybe some behind-the-scenes drama. What's that been like
so far?
Let's
get it out.
Yeah, well, Frank and I mean, I'm surprised we're even here together.
We don't get along.
We do not get along at all.
We're actually in different rooms right now on different microphones.
I'm calling in.
I just did a spit take on that one.
But I can tell you that's exactly what we just did is basically what this entire rehearsal process was like. We have the cast in this show that they've assembled for this sort of special summer. This is an additional thing that Perseverance is doing this summer, sort of in the 100th anniversary of the mine collapse is happening. And so this sort of is being done in conjunction with the Treadwell Preservation Society. And so the cast is made up of, you know, Frank and myself and Christina Apathy and Tom Robinault and just James Sullivan, who I last work with, an Odd Couple. And so we've just had a lot of laughs. We've got a couple of young people in the cast who have grown up through Star, who are playing some of the younger roles. And Brian Crowder, who's also been sort of doing some things at Perseverance, and
Callahan, Rebecca.
Yeah,
it's been truly an ensemble piece.
It's very ensemble. The story is ensemble piece, and the great thing I always like to say is that, you know, plays are about people and the conflicts that they have within the construct of the story that they're going through. So there's a lot of history that happens in terms of Treadwell Gold, which many Junoites may not know, and everybody who's heard the author and the playwright have probably heard about. So for us, though, it was also a little bit of a journey of discovery, you know, in terms of, like, I lived in South Douglas for a long time, and, you know, there's things that I didn't know about that were really awesome to learn. And then in the play, we have some of the history that's there, that's sort of things that people remember, things that people have heard about, mysteries. But then it's also, it is a fictional tale. There's things that happen in the play that didn't happen, or maybe we don't know if they happened. And so, but that's because we want to follow the stories of these people as they go through this journey. So we had a lot of laughs.
Yeah, no, it's been a great process. Yeah. And like I was saying just a minute ago before we turn on the mics, you know, I grew up right above South Douglas. You know, I'm from South Douglas, and I used to walk Sandy Beach or ride my bike down there almost pretty much every single day. And, you know, I thought I had a really good grasp on the history of Treadwell until I started doing this play, and then it was clear I had so much more to learn. You know, what this play really does really, really well is put the scale of Treadwell into perspective. You know, just how large this operation was and just how much of a catastrophe it was when it caved in. So, you know, even I thought I was very familiar with the whole thing, but I learned so much throughout this entire process. And like Boston said, it's just been so much fun from the very first table read all the way until our performances. We're having
mostly
a great
what
time.
I laughed at was Frank's huh face. Huh? Huh? I didn't know that.
Yeah. That's just what my face is.
And do you get to use that in your performance?
Yeah. No, that's all I do. I'm like, huh?
Huh? Huh? But, you know, it's one of the things that we marveled at, I think and one of the things that was sort of a running theme as we rehearsed was the idea of, you know, 900 and however many stamps that were going 24 hours a day and that you could hear that all the way down the channel. Just the immense, like, how loud that would
right,
be.
Right, it was literally the heartbeat of this area, you know, coming up Gasno. You could hear it from Juneau, you can hear it from Douglas,
yeah.
You definitely could hear it in Treadwell. You know, it became the heartbeat, so throughout this play, some of the sound design kind of pays homage to that, and you get a feel of the scale and, you know, the intensity of this particular place.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Huh. That's my hot face. Without any spoilers, can you talk a little bit about the characters you play?
Sure, yeah. I play Paul Crosby, who's the superintendent. That's a fictional name, but sort of based upon the superintendents who might have been around at the time. There were a few, and some of the things I say in the play, the warning I give near the end, actually, about how, you know, everything's going to be okay. Rachel just told me the other day that that's actual text that he said, which is pretty crazy.
Hmm.
So, I'm playing the fictional version. But so I play the superintendent, and I'm kind of the liaison between San Francisco and the owners and, you know, production and making sure everything's okay and kind of keeping the most positive face possible about everything that's happening and really thinking about the bottom line and the production. But I kind of learn my lesson as the play goes on and kind of figure out, like, oh, well, maybe there's a little bit more going on and things like that. So that's what I do.
Yeah, I play Charlie. And one thing that I'm sure they've talked about in some of the previous interviews with the playwright and the writer and the other cast is that the cast, like we said, it's more of a historical fiction. And all the characters in here are different composites of actual characters. So I don't know if we use any exact names, but I play the character Charlie, who's a Thinkit man. And he's based on this real-life miner named Axel. And I don't want to give too much away about what Charlie's journey is, but he is definitely based on someone's real life. And, you know, this particular interpretation has his outcome, which may or may not be true. So it's hard not to give too much.
I know.
But that is a lore, though. There's a piece of lore about a man who may or may not have survived. Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
I don't think that's giving away the whole thing. But there's pieces. That's what I'm saying. There's pieces in there that are like, well, you may have heard this, and so this is sort of a kind of telling of that. There's one of the big things that we're not sure. We don't know how it actually happened. The cave-in. There's people who've pondered and wondered about it, and there's been all kinds of science around it. And this play takes a specific journey with a person making decisions about that.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't have to do with our particular characters, but there's things that are sort of posited in the play as, oh, this may have been a way that this could have happened. So it's sort of a mixture of like history and fictional storytelling to create this sort of journey. And we're sort of both in a way, we're kind of supporting characters in the play.
Mm-hmm.
Really the story is about the family, the Lars and Greta and their
Bergmans.
Family, the Bergmans, who are Swedish, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then George, who's the young man who comes to Treadwell to be, he's a engineer who's come to do some things there, and he gets involved with their daughter. And now these things are all composited, right? So it's like the idea, but there were a lot of immigrants who came and worked at the mine. There were a lot of Alaskan natives who worked at the mine. And so there's a lot of different issues that are discussed and explored through these stories of these people, which is kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen the production yet, but I'm always curious about the set or the backdrop when I go to a play. Is there anything interesting about this one that you want to give as a little teaser?
Well, this is really interesting because this play has been a lot of black box theater. You know, it's at first glance it seems like a pretty simple set, but the more we go into it, we're actually enhancing the production through a lot of projections. So Josh Lohman, who's our on staff at Perseverance Theater and based out of Anchorage, came down here for tech, and he did a lot of different images and different graphics and animations and stuff to project onto the set. That makes it come alive, which is really, really interesting.
And then Lucy Peckham, who I've worked with as a director, and I think she's also been done stuff when I was an actor, but we did an Iliad together. She played the cello when I did an Iliad. And she's doing the sound design. And as mm-hmm. It's funny, because as we were rehearsing and we were realizing, okay, how do we do a cave-in? Like, how do you do, rocks falling?
Yeah,
we're not
going to
actually have
box.
Rocks falling, are we? Like, how are we going to do, like, the thing, the hoist that, you know, brings the guys
right.
up and down in the thing? So how are we going to do all of these, like, awesome things? And we were creative in terms of our staging and kind of thinking about that, but then when the technical elements started to come in, you sort of start to see, like, how this thing can be put together. And the magic of theater is that people are able to use their imaginations a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. That they're able to fill in some of the things that, you know, if this was a movie, you would have, you know, Hollywood-style
sure.
cave-ins. But we're not a movie. We're a theater. And so the idea of being there with these people as mm-hmm. they're reacting to these sounds and these sort of, like, Josh did these great kind of, they're not, like, specific images, they're sort of like ideas, they're
yeah.
sort of like abstracts a little bit, but you really are taken into this world because of that, and then that allows us as actors to sort of play the believability of that situation and kind of create the tension that's required. So the design is sort of helping us, we're mm-hmm. helping them to create this, like, you know, story that happens out of conflict. And
right, the audience sees us believing these situations, which
yeah.
makes them believe it, and they sort of fill it in. I mean, that's the beauty of black box theater.
And yeah.
That's exactly what we're doing in this production.
I just imagine that you're all standing on the trail. I've been on the trail so
yeah.
many times with a couple plaques around you and mm-hmm. performing like that.
Well, it's so fun. We went on a tour
right.
With
Historic,
Paulette,
Treadwell.
Who gave us a tour of Treadwell. We've walked over there
yeah.
all the time, and the stuff she was telling us was like, what?
I was like,
what?
Right here?
This happened? And then it was able to see, like, okay, well, oh, there was the superintendent's house. This is how far you would have had to walk to get to this place, or this
mm-hmm.
is what it would have sounded like, where all the boardwalks would have been, where, you know, where the old, the Treadwell, what was the...
Manatorium?
The thing, where they had the dances and stuff. I'm blanking on the name of it right now.
Oh, right, the
like
clubhouse.
The clubhouse. You know, where that was and the history of that and how that... It's just, so it helps us sort of get into that. And I think that's what people have been responding to, is the people who have been coming have
mm-hmm.
been... realizing that, yeah, they've probably been to Sandy Beach, to a bonfire, to a picnic, to a cookout, to
mm-hmm.
a thing, and there's this massive history there that lives there, that sort of breathes there in the land,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's really, it sort of comes alive for people as they watch the show a little bit.
And it was great because we had already started the rehearsal process. I think we were like a week into the rehearsal process where we
mm-hmm.
kind of sketched out all of our scenes. You know, we've started to become familiar with the story. And then we went on this walk, and we're like, oh, okay, so in, you know, scene 7,
yeah.
we're running from here to here, and this is the actual distance, and you kind of get perspective. So I think one of the cool things about this is that people can go walk Treadwell before they see the show, and they can go walk it again with a whole totally different lens and perspective
mm-hmm.
on
yeah,
what
it
is.
Yeah, it's so cool that it's just like steps away from the theater where
yeah.
you're actually performing the story of what happened. I don't
yeah.
think I've ever been to a play like that.
The first time, during the first read-through, we're like, wait, so this was right underneath us right now? And we're
yeah.
like, they're like 4,000
yeah.
feet of, you know, deep, and we're like, under us right here? And they're like, maybe not this far over, but...
Yeah, so I mean, I think it would be an interesting play for people who've been in Juneau a long time, but also for those people who've been in Juneau to bring people who are maybe newer to Juneau so that they can get a sense. I think there's a lot of, and there's tons of all kinds of history here, and this is just one of the many stories that exists here, but it's just a fascinating one to think about, and it's been 100 years, and to think about what that means and the history that's been left behind, and Sheila's book has been, you know, it's a great thing to see that stay alive through this idea of storytelling.
We're talking with Boston Christopher and Frank Koshkatas, both actors in the new play, Perseverance Theater, Treadwell Gold. One last question for you guys. Frank, you've authored an original play, and Boston, you've directed and been on the other side of it, as well as acting. So what's it like when you transition back and forth between these roles?
Well, it had to definitely dust off some rust, I think, to get back into my acting shoes. But it's been great. You know, I think, I always like, when I write from an actor's perspective on, like, things that I would like to do as an actor. So this play has a lot of juicy moments for an actor. It was pretty easy to make the transition back, but it was definitely like, oh, yeah, memorizing lines is hard. You know, so I was like, oh. Because when you're writing, you're like, just learn it. But no.
Yeah. Why did you come and memorize? Yeah. Learn those lines. I love the theater, and I love all different aspects of the theater, and really what I love is storytelling. And so whether I'm doing a play in front on the stage or whether I'm, you know, behind the scenes directing or even working on a play, a new play, I work on a lot of new plays and helping to structure story and things like that. It's all the same to me in that way. And it keeps me connected, really, is what it does. It's like, oh, yeah, what's it like to be? I mean, I think I'm first and foremost an actor. I mean, I think that's what I've been most of my life, and I love that way of telling a story. But there's a lot of stories that don't fit this particular body. People have ever seen me.
I'm first and foremost a plus size model.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. We're plus size models. I mean, there's certain stories that's how I started directing. Was there was a play that I read that I knew I couldn't be in, so I was like, well, I guess I have to direct that play, and that was 20 something years ago, and I was like, okay, well, that's the kind of plays I found to direct, and so because I also there's so many great plays to be in that I would, I want to do those roles too. So it's really just a matter of telling stories is what I love about it.
Great. Well, thank you guys so much for being here. I have to say, I've seen you both perform, and you're both my favorite. So it's a big, like, that's definitely part of the draw.
But who's your real favorite?
Yeah, who do you like more? Oh, she's pointing at me. What does that mean?
You're both my favorites. The play has a very short run, so don't hesitate. Go and see it.
Can I mention this, that we have a special. We're playing through the weekend. You can go to ptalaska.org and find out the schedule. But we have a very cool special performance on Monday night, July 3rd, which is right before fireworks, and you can stick around and toast the end of the season with Perseverance if you come to the show on Monday. And we don't usually do plays on Monday night, so I think it's part of that idea of, you know, 4th of July. The play begins and opens and ends on 4th of July, and so it's sort of a really great opportunity to experience that. But the website, and then what's the phone number, Frank, if people want to get to
463-TIXS.
There you go.
All right, thank you guys both so much for being here. I will definitely go see that performance. And I encourage everybody else to do so.
Thank you.
You gotta know I'm feeling loved, made it gold. I never loved her. Another one, another you, it's gotta be, love, I said it, you gotta know, I'm feeling love, you gotta know, I'm feeling love, you gotta know, I'm feeling love, made it gold, I'm ever lover, another one, another you. I might as well be in our garden. I said, I smell in the air is a dripping rose.
You know, you be the one for me.
Another soul to be my warden.
of anything there that's made of gold. A physical kiss is nothing without it. And you close your eyes to see what it's done. The body that lies is built up on looking. It's all that remains before it's begun.
Fjords in Alaska are important harbor seal nursery habitats. NOAA Fisheries reminds boaters to maintain distance from seals hauled out on ice. Go slow to minimize weight. Avoid thick ice cover where seals congregate and keep noise down to allow seals to give birth and rear pups without disturbance in these sensitive areas. Be seal aware. Approach with care. This message sponsored by NOAA Fisheries Alaska Region.
This is Sarah Raster from the Year of Kindness Steering Committee. As part of 17YOK, all sorts of groups are adopting specific weeks during which they do something to help spread kindness. This week's group is CrossFit Juno. You can sign up for a week by emailing 17YOK@junopolice.com. Together, we can make Juno a better place to live.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon. It is about 17 minutes to the top of the hour. And with me are my next guests, Mike Blackwell and Kaya Hendrickson from the City Museum downtown. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You are welcome. Kaya, I interviewed you a few weeks back ahead of a First Friday event. I don't know if you remember, but because of your enthusiasm and all the information that you gave me, I visited the museum, the City Museum, for the first time.
Oh, excellent. That's great.
So thank you for that. Okay. So you're both here to talk a little bit about the Downtown Geology Walking Tour. That sounds like it rocks. I had to do it. So please share some details with us.
Okay, so the tour will take place on July 6th, so that's next Thursday, and it starts at 5:30 p.m. at the City Museum, and it ends at 7 p.m. at the Downtown Public Library.
So it's a one-time deal?
It's a one-time deal, although we've had already a lot of interest, and so we're hoping to be able to offer it again later in the summer if the hosts are available. So the tour leaders are Mike Blackwell, who's here with me today, and then Kathy Connor, who's a professor emeritus of geology from UAS.
Excellent. So what's interesting about the geology in downtown Juneau?
Well, it's all interesting.
Of course.
But in terms of things that people might be interested in, we'll talk about the glaciers, all aspects of geology, rocks, soil, ice, water, both salt and fresh, and we'll try to have something interesting and perhaps even amusing dealing with each of those geological substances.
Are there any? Oh, go ahead.
This isn't a lecture on foot. This is, I hope, a conversation where we can chat about what we see and what the group's interests might be, and sort of have a long chat, an hour and a half long. Kathy and I did a lecture at the City Museum back last fall, indoors. And what we're going to do now is something much the same, except that it's going to be outdoors, and we can point to the rocks and minerals and ice and other aspects rather than to have to show it on a screen in a lecture situation.
I don't know if this is interesting to anyone else besides me, but what are some of the most common rock types found around here?
Right here in the center of Juneau, we have a lot of sand and gravel and mud, which are rock types.
Rock types, yes.
Under that we have chiefly low rank to medium rank metamorphic rocks. Rocks metamorphosed or changed by heat and other processes which were initially marine or volcanic deposits that have been cooked, if you will.
Volcanic deposits?
Volcanic, yes.
Were there ever volcanoes in this region?
Must have been. Yes, these were probably submarine volcanoes.
Okay, so that means underwater?
Yes.
And they would spew up?
Yes, they've been cooked and then squeezed up and eroded, and now we can see them as our mountains. To the east, there's granite. To the west, there's lots of other interesting things. Kathy is a general geologist, retired from the university here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a retired geological engineer. We're going to tell folks about the geology, and then we're going to discuss how that geology, in the broadest sense, has influenced the growth and development of Juneau.
That sounds fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about the route you'll be walking on the tour?
Yes. It's about 2 miles long, all flat or downhill. We'll begin at the museum and then ease along Calhoun, looking both up and down to the 12th Street Calhoun Bridge, just at the entrance to Cope Park.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll cut down Capitol Avenue through the flats, making a few side trips to look at Gold Creek, our unruly Gold Creek, or formerly unruly Gold Creek. And then we'll come along the waterfront and end up at the downtown library upstairs, providing a nice view of the channel and Douglas Island and everything else that folks want to talk about.
That sounds great. I'm so excited. I've been really interested in the tour ever since I heard about it. You mentioned Gold Creek is unruly. Why do you say that?
Oh, in the period dating back from the beginning of settlement and to, let's say, the 1920s, and even later than that, Gold Creek was subject to some very severe flooding because it's on a delta and it was unconstrained, so it wandered back and forth across its delta that forms the wedge or triangular piece of ground between 12th Street and Capitol Avenue.
Oh, I never knew that.
And there's some other factors at play. And we'll, in addition to the fact that now the creek's in a concrete box, there's some other further upstream factors that are also influencing the and for that reason, flood damage is rare these days.
I see. Yeah, it seems like it's pretty under control, even when it's high and rushing and making a lot of noise. I live up above it, so I hear it a lot. And I walk that area all the time, so I'm really interested in learning more about what I'm looking at on my walks. A lot of people walk that area. It's very popular. Are there any particular geological features that hold special meaning to any groups that have inhabited Juneau over the hundreds of years, thousands of years?
Well, I think the channel.
Yeah.
It was and still is in a large measure our chief mode of transportation, both before the mining days began, and certainly now. And it's the thing that I like to look at. And I think about the fact that its location and is controlled by a fault that's no longer active, I might add.
Phew.
So there's the Gastineau Channel Fault.
Very interesting.
And there's different rocks on both sides of it. And over there, just like a foreign country, is Douglas.
So far away. So exotic.
But people think about the mountains, too.
Yeah, of course.
Especially Mount Roberts and Mount Juneau and the mountains on Douglas. And we can talk about why they're there. And then think about the higher peaks to the east when we can see them,
mm-hmm.
which are granite-like rocks.
Kaya, can you tell us the details of the walk one more time?
Sure. So it starts at 5:30 at the City Museum, and it ends at 7 at the Downtown Library, and that's on July 6th. The cost of the tour is $25 for adults and $20 for children 12 and under. And included in the cost of the tour is free admission to the City Museum and
Excellent.
Also a 20% coupon for our gift shop. Space is limited, and in fact, just today, we have gotten to the point before I left the museum of being almost sold out.
Okay.
So, we're hoping, as I said, that we'll be able to repeat the tour later this summer. And if not, Mike Blackwell is actually one of our regular downtown walking tour guides. So we have downtown historic walking tours Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at 1:30 every week. And Mike does the Thursday tour. And those tours are usually pretty small groups, and the tour guide can often tailor the tour to the interest. So if someone was interested in learning more about the geology and they can't make it to this walk, they could always come on one of the Thursday downtown tours.
Well, that's wonderful. You guys are just so helpful. Yes, Mike.
The Thursday walk, I might add, is general Juneau history.
Okay.
And, of course, you can't say anything about general Juneau history without talking about the geology.
No, you can't.
But the focus is people and other things. Another point I should add is that this is not at all a technical discussion. It's designed for people that are curious, but not necessarily with a scientific or technical background.
Okay. So anybody can join. It's not just for, like, geology PhD
the
students.
The only requirement is that they be curious.
Okay. That's excellent. Well, I'm very curious. And I'm really glad you guys are offering this. And what else is going on at the City Museum, Kaya?
Well, starting this weekend, we're going to be open 7 days a week through September. We received some generous donations to allow us to be open on Sundays from 10 to 4:30. So
well, that's great news.
Yeah, we're really happy about that. We just opened up our application process for solo and group artist shows. So if there are any artists out there listening and you're interested in exhibiting at the museum, these would be for exhibits taking place during the 2018-19 season, but you can get a copy of the application at the museum or download it from our website, which is www.juneau.org/library/museum. We're also doing another family day this month, and that'll be taking place on Sunday, July 3rd from 1 to 3 p.m., and adults with children get free admission during that time. This month's focus is going to be on fishing, so we'll have a knot tying activity. We have a great new fish interactive where we have some life-size salmon and a halibut and some smaller fish that have the fish on one side, so you can hold it and it looks like you caught a real fish. And then on the back side are all the facts about the fish.
That sounds awesome. I love the City Museum. All your exhibits are so neat and quirky like that.
Thanks.
Go on.
And so that'll be on the 23rd from 1 to 3. And of course, families can just come and enjoy the museum during that time as well. They don't have to participate in the activity at any time. And we had our first family day just a couple weeks ago, and it was really successful. So we're hoping to encourage more families to come down and check us out.
Great. And all that information is available on your website. Yeah?
That is correct.
And you said the walking tour is getting pretty full. So if people are listening and they want to buy tickets right now, where should they go?
So you can either come to the museum at the corner of 4th and Main, or you can call 586-3572 and pay over the phone. We do need payment in order to make the reservation.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, thank you both for being here. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish up? Mike's got nothing.
Yeah. I guess come see us at the City Museum. We have a lot of new exhibits, and there's a lot of things for everybody there.
Great, great. I'm so happy you guys are going to be open more. That's fantastic. Well, thanks again for being here today.
Thank you.
Hearing American crows defending their nest, protecting their young. Although the American crow may seem rather blasé about pillaging another bird's nest, like that of this house finch, it regards a threat to its own young as a punishable offense. Crows are territorial, very protective of their food sources, ferocious and fearless as parents. Young crows fledge, or leave the nest, when they're around 5 or 6 weeks old and nearly the same size as adults. But they still can't feed or protect themselves. Fortunately, their parents look out for them for months. In fact, immature crows don't mate until they're at least 2 years old. They often stay with the family all that time, learning from the parents, and even helping with next year's brood. To protect their young, adult crows dive bomb people, cats, and other birds or animals. They strike with their feet, whip with their wings, and peck if they get a chance. The best thing you can do when there are baby crows around is keep your distance.
Today's show is brought to you by White Flower Farm, a family-owned mail-order nursery offering a wide range of perennials, annuals, and shrubs for early summer planting. More information is at whiteflowerfarm.com.